Good morning. I'm calling the meeting of the Select Committee on Minnesota's Pandemic Response and Rebuilding to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Hartman?
Present.
Majority Leader Winkler?
Present.
Minority Leader Dowd? Representative Carlson?
Present.
Representative Garofalo?
Present.
Representative Garofalo?
Present.
Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Present.
Representative Morrison? Representative New?
Present.
Representative Poppy?
Present.
Minority Leader Dowd? Minority Leader Dowd?
Present.
Representative Morrison? Madam Speaker, all members except Representative Morrison are present.
First, we will approve the minutes from the meeting on Friday, June 5th. Representative Winkler, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Madam Chair, I have, and I move approval of those minutes.
Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. I see that Representative Morrison has joined us. So I don't know if we have to return to the clerk taking the roll, if we can just note that for the record. I think we can just note that. So we'll proceed right on to the agenda. We have a really full agenda. I'm really grateful for the individuals who have agreed to share their expertise with us this morning. We're going to start with a presentation from Andy Slavitt from United States of Care. Please welcome to the committee, Mr. Slavitt. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Andy Slavitt, the board chair of United States of Care. Thank you, Speaker Hortman, Minority Leader Dowd, and members of the committee for inviting me. Minnesotans, and indeed all Americans, and indeed all the people on the planet, are going through very challenging times. Obviously, we're seeing a number of deaths that we haven't seen in nearly 100 years. It leaves people with great fear and uncertainty, confusion around the facts, and of course, the economic impacts that result from that. Small businesses closing, loss of employment, anxiety and fear, and soon, even greater potential challenges. We will see, beginning shortly, more and more evictions and foreclosures around the country, and hunger. In Minnesota, by this fall, one in five children will not know where their next meal is coming from. That compares to a not so great record of one in eight normally. So I know this is a frightening time. And so I'm here to share some good news, to talk candidly about the challenges we face, and then to close with some more good news. The good news is that with all the time that I've spent with leaders around the country, with scientists, with Congress, with epidemiologists, that with the right strategy and the right approach, we can get through this virus. We can live with this virus, and we can indeed have our economy back, even with this virus. We may not have it exactly as we want, but it is possible. And we know that it's possible because it has been tamed in countries around the world, ranging from the Czech Republic to Hong Kong, to New Zealand, to Germany, to Greece. So this is a very diverse set of countries, and they have a number of things in common, which I will go through. But to give you an idea, Vietnam had 330 cases, no deaths, because they have a very active testing regimen. And their economy is going to grow this year 2.7%. So there's a very strong link between how safe we can make people feel and how much we can help people with these challenges and how their economy can get back to normal as quickly as possible. There have also been states in the U.S. that have been successful, starting with our own response, which I think has been strong. But also other states have also done well, and I think they all have had in common is by treating this as an attack on the population, taking it seriously, communicating often, and it is not with regard to political party either. Some of the best responses have come from Ohio and Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, California, and I've spent time with both people in those states and in other places, and there's a clear path of things that work. Number one is having a clear plan and having it be science-based and be willing to adjust the plan along the way. Number two is a willingness to make short-term sacrifices for long-term success. If anybody is unwilling to take any measures, then it prolongs the agony, and I'll talk about that in a second. Third is a set of containment tools so that when you have new cases, which you're going to have, it's just going to be a part of life, instead of becoming raging forest fires, we can contain them to just be small embers that we can put out. And that means more adequate testing. It means the ability to isolate people. It means the ability to help people realize who they have infected. It means hypervigilance. It means not dismissing new cases as, oh, that's just 1,000 new cases, or, oh, those are just young people, because with an asymptomatic spreading disease, every case needs to be contained. It means masks, and it means community and social cohesion. It means getting a similar message from people all across of leadership, which is one of the reasons why I so applaud this group convening on a bipartisan basis to hopefully put aside partisan differences and talk about how to support the state. And it means differentiating how we treat communities because rural and urban communities are going to go through things in different ways at different times. But if you do those things, the economy begins to open. If you don't do those things, you have what I would call a 75% economy. That's an economy based on bars, delivery services, retail, but you don't have the things that really drive an economy, which are consumer spending, travel, people signing leases, people buying cars, people spending money on vacations. Those things just don't happen when people feel unsafe. So we take those steps, I think we also would get our economy back. Now, a month ago, I was spending a lot of time talking to the people in Arizona and in Texas because they were feeling pretty good about the fact that their opening, they did not feel had caused any issues. They opened more rapidly than Minnesota did. But I'll tell you that on May 1st, Arizona had about 8,000 cases. Minnesota had about 6,000 cases. Arizona, as people know by now, opened very rapidly, didn't do contact tracing, didn't do masks, didn't take the viruses seriously. And today that 8,000 has become 100,000. Our 6,000, while it's grown to 38,000, it demonstrates that we've done a much better job by simply taking it stepwise. And I know that it tries people's patience because people want their lives back. I get that. But the benefit is enormous when you do that. And today, when you talk to the Governor Abbott in Texas, I think it's fair to say he regrets not taking preventive measures. The problem with this virus, the challenge with this virus that we all have, is it does its damage when nobody sees it. Because it's in the 2 to 3 weeks when you think you're doing fine that it actually moves across the population. It's after, and likewise, the reverse can be true. Things are getting better before you see it in the data because of the way that works. Unfortunately, I would tell you that in Minnesota, we have not seen the worst of it. So as good a job as we've done, I'm fearful that it's going to get worse here. And the reason I say that is because we are in what I would call the second step of phase one. The first step was the largest cities in New York, in Detroit, New Jersey. The second step are the cities in the South, largely, I believe, because the hot weather forces people indoors more. There's recirculated air. I don't think it has much to do with outdoor gatherings, to be honest. I think it has a lot more to do with the humidity in places like Houston and the heat in places like Phoenix and Los Angeles and Miami and Charlotte. And people travel to those cities because they're bigger than the Twin Cities. But that doesn't mean that we're spared. Just like Arizona and Texas, I think we could be sitting here a month out from when it really gets here. And I know it feels to people like it's been bad here, but I don't think we've seen anything yet. And so I think we have plenty, we have time, but we need to act and we need to stay urgent. We need to stay vigilant because, again, it's when you think you've beaten this that it becomes its greatest challenge. And I think Governor Abbott is probably the best evidence of that. And I applaud him for, in Texas, reversing course and closing bars, which he opened too hastily, and requiring mask use, which I know in Texas was a big cultural decision, a big tough issue. But I applaud him for doing that. I want to close with a couple things. First of all, I promised some more good news, and there is good news. There is going to be light at the end of the tunnel here. For people who think that this is endless, for the many people who have sacrificed in so many ways, I want you to know that you have been giving your scientists time, and they have made really good use of it. Compared to when this was in New York in March and April, we have much better therapies. And I think Dr. Wheeler can talk about this. We have much better procedures for how we ventilate people. We have drugs now that are proving to be effective at some of the biggest complications from COVID, such as blood clotting, such as poor oxygenation, such as an overly active immune system response, which you probably read about. All of those things we are beginning to have treatments against. Furthermore, we now have, I think, made some very good progress on towards vaccines. And I think I would just offer this with regard to the vaccines. I think we will have good vaccines. I think vaccines will get here much sooner than it has ever happened in the history of medicine. I would also say the vaccines are going to work like the influenza vaccine, most likely on some portion of the population, but not everybody. So it won't be, I don't think you should think of a vaccine as there's a world before the vaccine and a world after the vaccine. I think you should look at it instead as part of the arsenal of improvement efforts that we have that will, over time, reduce the spread and eliminate and reduce the fatality. That will mean that things like masks are going to be part of the equation. That will mean very likely that better therapies will be part of the equation. And there are some really promising therapies. There's really promising work in T cells, and it's happening very rapidly. And so between that and the fact that we are people who are most at risk are taking better care of themselves, I think that's great. Having said all of those good things, we have to remember that there are people that are forced to go to work every day. We call them essential workers. I don't think they feel very good about that. And when we come in contact with them, and when we come in contact with our healthcare workforce, and people get in front of our healthcare workforce, we are putting a burden on them so that they don't have a choice about. So if we are going to see them, we have to recognize that we have an obligation to them because of the sacrifice they're taking. I'm going to close with just a few pieces of information I'm going to just say directly for the public to the extent that people are listening in. It's advice based on everything I've heard. The first is that I know the news that comes out of this is confusing. The scientific process feels like it's two steps forward, one step back. It's hard to know what to believe. It's hard, you know, you're told one day that masks work and another day that they don't. You're told one day that there's a drug that doesn't work and then it does and then it doesn't. This is normal. This is how the process works. You are watching science unfold. This is not a bad thing. The more information and the more time we have, the more we'll get to better answers. My recommendation is that you and your family sit down every 2 weeks and reassess the decisions that you've made and your understanding of things, because things will continue to evolve. And one day it may feel like it's not safe to play outdoors. And then later on, we learn that it is safe to play outdoors or to run outdoors in small groups. So it's important that you get used to the fact that we're going to continue to see changing information. Some things that we believe today that are true won't be true. Some things we don't think are true today may end up being true. Second is, if you live anywhere where people are required to work in a grocery store, in a bar, a delivery service, and you're going to come in contact with any of them, wear a mask. Do it for them. Do it for their families. You have no idea what their family situation is like. But I can tell you from talking to a number of them that when someone comes in without a mask and buys groceries from them, or it feels very disrespectful. So whether we have a mandate or not, which I think is a good idea, I think as Minnesotans, it's an important thing for us to do. We do know that based on a recent study that over a 5-week period, mask wearing is reduced in a number of counties. It reduced the number of cases by between 230,000 and 450,000. Third, make decisions on what your sacrifice is in during the course of this event. We will not all be able to have everything we want. We want schools to open. We want to be able to hang out with our friends. We want to visit our parents. We want to be able to do a lot of things. But we have to choose sometimes. So if we can choose to go to bars, which I think are a dangerous place for the virus to spread, that makes it less likely or more challenging for schools to open. So we have to make choices, because people are contributing in so many different things in so many different ways to get the things that we want. And I hope we make those as a society and with healthy conversation. Fourth is, there's just no better time to be a friend or a neighbor than right now. As bad as you may be having it, there are other people having it worse. There are other people that are alone, that are challenged, and it is a great time to show who we are. Fifth, this whole thing is nobody's fault. I know that at times it's tempting to blame the president or the governor or another elected official or your neighbor. But the truth is that there is one bad guy here, and the bad guy is the virus. Nobody wishes this on anybody. And if we start from the premise of that there are people that are at fault here, I think we will be at each other's throats. We will make bad decisions. We won't be unified here. The truth is, we can decide how we respond, and we should be accountable for how we respond. But we are all in this together. And that leaves me with my final point, which is to thank this committee and the leaders in the state, from Governor Walz to this committee to the legislature, for setting an example of leading in a way that tries to put politics aside, that tries to unify the state, and tries to help make the best decisions we can all the way through it. So thank you for that, and thank you for the time.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for Mr. Slavitt? I'm out of practice of chairing a committee. You know, when you're holding a gavel at the front of the house, you don't introduce people. But I forgot to indicate for the record that Andy Slavitt is the former acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and as he stated, the board chair of United States of Care. And I know that part of the reason I asked Mr. Slavitt to testify here is I'm as many of us are, closely following the commentary, comparing different jurisdictions and the public policy decisions they're making and the different results they're having. And I know, Mr. Slavitt, you're looking at decisions that are being made all over the country and all over the world. I wonder if you have some thoughts on those jurisdictions which have reopened schools and what impact the school age population has. That is an area that I would say that legislators probably get asked about the most from our constituents.
And look, it's the most confusing and challenging area because we all know the right thing to do for kids is to have them in school. And we all want that. And I think the question is how. And then there's a lot of complicating factors. If there wasn't such a thing as teachers, maybe that'd be easier. But as parents have learned over the last few weeks and months, being a teacher is not easy. It's one thing to raise your kid. It's another thing to have them sit in their chair and learn math. We're going to have a suboptimal school year where everybody doesn't get what they want. There's conflicting data. In Spain, there's data which showed that kids spread the virus less to other kids and to adults. If that holds up, it's an observation, it would be great news. There's data in Israel, unfortunately, which shows where kids have been spreading the data frequently. And so while I think that schools are going to be a big decision and a big challenge, there is some risk. And I think we are going to have ideally conversations at the family level, at the parent level, about people's situation. If someone has a sick family member at home, what kind of risk that takes. If somebody has access to meals at home, if somebody has access to Wi-Fi at home, versus somebody that doesn't have a sick parent at home, does have access to meals at home, or doesn't, I should say, and doesn't have access to Wi-Fi. And there are no doubt can be safe ways and safe settings to try to construct schools. Ideally, we would have more testing. Ideally, we would have science a little bit further along. I'm afraid we're going to have to make some decisions with uncertain information, and we're going to have to be prepared to adjust. And I would just suggest that people get themselves in a mind frame of being flexible and understanding it's going to be an imperfect year. I'm guessing it may only be this semester. It may be this entire year. Very good chance it won't be the following year. And I know that's hard. We all want the best for our kids. It's all of our top priority. So we're going to have to pull together and figure this out.
Thank you. We have three questions. We'll take these three questions from members, and then depending upon what time it is, we may then proceed to our next testifier. So first, Representative Garofalo, then Representative Morrison, then Representative Carlson. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Can you hear me okay?
You could be a little louder.
That's the last time I'm going to hear that, right? Yep. To the testifier, thank you for your testimony. Two quick questions. One, we talked about schools, but how about college dormitories and college classes? Do we have a different set of metrics we use to evaluate whether a higher education institution should be opening their dorms or not?
Yeah, there's three additional factors in higher education that are obvious. One is living situation. Second is bathroom situation. And the third is how close or open the campus is. There's probably a fourth, which is how much of the kids party, to be honest. But I think we can assume the fourth one as a given. I have a 22-year-old and an 18-year-old, so I'm not throwing stones at anybody. I think universities and schools who can are trying to figure out if they can create living situations where they rotate kids in, where they can be more single, or in the case of a commuter school, they can live at home. It's easier to do classes online for older kids than it is for younger kids, although the kids don't like that obviously as much. But certainly for bigger classes, there's more of a track record. The kids can learn that way. Likewise, the sort of the bathroom situations. I suspect we're going to have situations where schools open and close and open and close. If I were a university president, and I've talked to a number of them, I'd say the things you want to have in place are surveillance testing, so that you can test asymptomatic kids, because 30 to 40% of the students who get the virus are going to be asymptomatic. If you don't have enough tests to do asymptomatic testing, it feels like you're spoiling for a very short semester, that kids are going to be back home soon. They're going to give it the college try. I mean, candidly, there's a lot of money at stake for schools and for universities, so I think they're going to try. But there are a lot of factors which will make this complex.
Thank you.
So, Madam Speaker and
Representative Garofalo, brief follow-up.
Yep, I have like two quick questions. One is, so when it comes to higher ed in K-12, are we better off having one policy for our whole state, or should we give guidance to local jurisdictions to kind of come up with their own flexibility?
So it's a great question. I'm a believer that different parts of the state are going to experience this thing differently at different times. So if you had a county that was in northern Minnesota or southern Minnesota where there were no cases, there's not a lot of travel, very few cases, and they had the containment tools, but you had raging case growth somewhere else in the state, I wouldn't want to keep those kids out of school. If I didn't have containment tools, I'd be a little bit more nervous. But certainly, we shouldn't make any extra person have to suffer. Because look, 6 months later, it could be the reverse. 6 months later, that other area could be facing challenges and may not be able to go into school for a short period of time. And the first area may be able to. And you wouldn't want to have it so that nobody went at all. That'd be my view.
Representative Garofalo.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much to the testifier for joining us today and for your service to our country. I think I heard you correctly, but I just want to be sure. Would you encourage an indoor public mask mandate, do you think, in Minnesota?
I would. I would, because we have a mandate that people have to work and be around us. And so if someone's going to see my face, be forced to see my face, that the least I could do would be to put a mask on. I will say this, that people hate the word mandate. People hate mandates in this country. Now, we have seatbelt mandates, we have other mandates that are safety, but I understand that people don't like to be told what to do. I would hope that just given who we are as Minnesotans, that we would say, whether it's a mandate or not, I want to do this. And it's a norm and it's helpful. And indeed, much of the polling suggests that most people agree with that. There's obviously vocal minorities. They ought to be listened to. I don't think anybody's views ought to be dismissed. I don't think that the answer is to shove a scientific paper in someone's face and say, why aren't you wearing a mandate, a mask? These are trying times enough. Don't fray your relationships. Talk to people about why it's important to you. If you have a sick parent, elderly parent or a sick child, tell people that I wear a mask because of that. And that's why I need to be only around people that wear masks. And I think that helps. I do think that like Texas, which probably is the state which is culturally least likely to put in place a mandate, realize that even with all the best intentions, a mandate just makes it easier because it just takes the question off the table.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Morrison?
No, that's great. Thank you very much.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Slavitt, a couple of points that you made. You said we're in phase two and that we haven't seen anything yet. So I'd like you to put your crystal ball on, or look into your crystal ball, I should say, and give us a feel for what we might anticipate. And then in the popular press, they're talking about at times a recurrence in the fall. And you referenced the South, and you said that they were indoors a lot because of humidity. Well, in Minnesota, come fall and winter, we're going to be indoors a lot, not due to humidity, but due to cold weather. So kind of looking into your crystal ball, what can we anticipate for what I'll call phase three, which is more short term? And then if you could comment on what we might expect in the fall, when Minnesotans begin to be indoors more due to humidity.
Mr. Slavitt.
Yeah, well, I think the snowshoers will do better because they'll get the outdoor piece. I still haven't figured out how to do that without falling. Nobody knows the future. And I hope that I'm wrong. But you're absolutely right, Representative Carlson, in that the features of the bug that we're learning about so far are that it spreads indoors when people are spending a lot of time indoors around the same people, particularly larger crowds, and particularly if it's poorly circulating air. So if we lived in a climate where we could keep our windows and doors open, it would be a lot better. If we lived in a climate where, or we worked in an environment where we could be home and not out in an enclosed office space with very, very tight building and low ventilation, things would be better. But that's a factor that concerns me. A second factor on top of that, as people have talked about, is the flu season occurring at the same time. And I'm sure that if Dr. Wheeler speaks, she can talk about that. That's not an abnormal. The two of those things together are also quite challenging. So what do I expect? I expect that even with all of those threats, if we pull together, do the right things, we can manage through this. That's going to mean some of the things we talked about. It's going to mean a little bit of sacrifice. It's going to mean everybody not getting what they want. It's probably going to mean indoor restaurants and bars are not open. And that's not an easy answer. We have to figure out how to solve that. We all know people who own those places and we love those places. We love those people. It probably means that we're wearing masks. It probably means that we're taking a bunch of these things seriously. And it means that every time there's a case, we jump all over it and diagnose them as early as possible. They're going to happen. I mean, the cases are going to happen. What we're trying to prevent are them from getting out of control. And the final thing I'll say is, some good luck can come our way by the fall. So every day or week or month you put this off, you're in better shape. I recall at the beginning of this, people saying, well, I want to get it early while there's a ventilator, because people were already running out of ventilators. Turned out that would have been the wrong strategy. Back then, 80% of people who went on ventilators didn't make it. Today, I don't know the statistics here in Minnesota, but around the country, that number is dropping like a stone. The number of people who are going to survive on a ventilator is going to be quite high because we have just better procedures. We've learned more about this. So every day that we go by without having a crush is a day that we're going to do better if it ever comes.
Thank you, Mr. Slavitt. And you set up your next testifier really well. I do just have to note for the record, as a cross-country skier, if you do snowshoe in the winter, please do not snowshoe on top of the Nordic track that your friends have created with their cross-country skis. And with that...
That's not a problem, huh?
Well, just as long as you stay away the cross-country ski trails, you're good. Snowshoeing's just fine. And with that, I will go to our next testifier, Penny Wheeler, who is the president and CEO of Allina Health. Thank you for joining us this morning, and please provide your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Chair Hortman, and thank you, members of the committee, and appreciate this opportunity to give an update on what COVID-19 has meant for us as a healthcare system. Appreciate the other testifiers on this, too, and always learning from everybody else. So thank you for that. As Chair Hortman said, I am the president and CEO of Allina. I'm a physician by background, and I have the unique opportunity of getting to lead and serve the organization in which I was born and practice for decades. So that's great, which means I've been hanging around here for quite a long time. It also means I've seen things like I'm being proud of our preparedness for Ebola, our response to 35W bridge crash, our how we dealt through a great recession, and we've not seen anything like this, and all of you know it. The way that this virus has impacted our community and subsequently with the pandemic has been remarkable. There's nobody in our organization and in any healthcare organization that's been untouched. I want to talk about basically three things, and maybe I'll start with and end with gratitude, but the three things I want to talk about is how we've been readied, how we've collaborated, and how we've approached recovery and the challenges and opportunities that come with that. So I'll start with that. It's like I said, everybody has been impacted, you know, across the organization. The scale of this is nothing we've seen before. So every single aspect of our organization and every other healthcare organization, from supply chain folks to environmental services to the caregivers in the hospitals and the clinics to transportation to EMS services to the lab to everything, occupational health, everything and more has been impacted by this. And of course, everybody, like all of you, hold your back personal stories that you're carrying because our lives have turned upside down in addition. We're really proud of some of the things that have been accomplished, and gratitude will start with giving us time, as Andy Slavitt said, to do the preparations necessary to both prepare to safely care and care well for COVID patients, to give us the opportunity also to care for people who are struggling with non-COVID care, like pancreatic cancer or uncontrolled diabetes, or delivering twins, you know, to care for those people in concert with that. With the virus. So the time is been used wisely, and I'll say it's been used a lot wisely by us and other healthcare systems in Minnesota. We as an organization are proud that we were able to use that time to double our ICU capacity, to make sure we increased our med-surg capacity by 50%, and to learn about this, where things were changing day by day, minute by minute. And Andy Slavitt raised some of these things, but we now treat people, you know, differently than we did before. We know that you don't put everybody on a respirator right away. You lose other techniques to do their respiratory care. We know that there's organ support that you can give people. You know that where there are new drug therapies coming out, and remdesivir is one of the ones that's being distributed. You know that there are trials going out for convalescent plasma that seems to be improving, and Mayo is leading that. We're the number one. We're proud to be the number one enroller of that in the country right now. And we're looking at more things. So the time has given us time not only to prepare with making sure we have the adequate space and equipment and staff preparation, but it's also given us time to learn more about the virus. And I will say, Andy, to what we're seeing about survivability rates, we're seeing that of those who have to go on ventilators, about 75% of them are now surviving. So almost the inverse of what was seen early in New York. So we're seeing good things happening because the time afforded by the public, because of the measures taken to allow us to learn and prepare in better ways. I'll also say that new things are coming in that preparation. So as you know, we've changed our care model almost dramatically in days, something that used to take years. So we used to have 60 virtual care appointments a day. Now we're up to 6,000 per day. And virtual care. And that includes really important things like mental health and addiction services that are actually taken with the care team into somebody's home now who is struggling with that and feels all the more isolated because of the virus. So those are things we're happy to, as well as our partnerships in Step Down Care with Presbyterian Homes and many other things. So that's how we prepared for this, and we feel prepared. We've even gone to the extent of doing tabletop exercises to make sure that if we're over capacity in any way, that we can make sure that we distribute the patients, COVID and non-COVID, in a right and safe way for people. Or, forbid, we get into a situation where we have a scarcity of either drug therapies or ventilators or staffing, and what do we do? And we've done tabletop exercises for even scarcity things. So all that to say is the time has been afforded and we have prepared well. Let me talk about collaboration next. And I see Jennifer on the screen here, and we've gotten to know each other really well as health system leaders across this state. We speak weekly and oftentimes more than weekly to make sure that we were doing everything well and collaboratively together. We've done that with the Minnesota Department of Health, we've done that with the governor's office, and we've done that collectively. So we try to make sure that we give consistent advice about public health measures, about measures for safety in our environments, about all of those things, and we're doing it together. I can tell you that that is atypical. I talk to my colleagues around the country, and it is unusual for people even to talk to each other, let alone coordinate the way that we have as health system leaders and the state. And it's remarkable, and I'm proud to be a Minnesotan and a lifelong Minnesotan because of it. So I am grateful for that collaboration. Let me talk too about recovery efforts, even before we're out of the thick of all of this. Andy wisely said, and we are certainly aware that while we had a peak in our system. Again, we represent about a third of the COVID patients hospitalized and are hospitalized in the Allina system right now. We had a peak in late May of 208 patients. We're now at 82. We look at these things daily, but we cannot be lulled or have any kind of caution fatigue here because of the exponential nature of this virus and this disease. So we have to be really, really prepared for that. And let me also say that part of the recovery entails not only preparation for something that could surge and the public health efforts that are needed to avoid that surge, but we also uncovered and our eyes were wider open with the racial pandemic that exists as well. The inequities that exist around COVID, the disproportionate people of color who are affected by the virus, and then now with eyes wider open post the George Floyd and the civil unrest here, that we realize that part of our charge for recovery is not only to make sure that we recover from this, that they rewrite the ship of not-for-profit healthcare and the gravity of the financial challenges, which I'll speak to in a minute, but that we also attend to our community in a deeper way to do all possible to limit inequities and racial disparities in care. We have, as many of you know, where our headquarters are. We're in the heart of Ground Zero of where the civil unrest took place. And we committed to this community, and we have for 133 years, and we're not going away anytime soon. And we need to not only deepen deepen and amplify our efforts in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion and close this gap. The COVID virus highlighted that for us. Our civil unrest certainly did as well. And in the words of one of our board members, we've had peace. We've had quiet, but we haven't had peace. I think one of the best things that can happen out of this is where these issues are being raised more and are loudly raised, and that gives us a chance to deal with them. This COVID virus gives us a chance to do things that make healthcare better for people, that extend healthcare to their home as much as care expertise and talent will allow. It gives us a chance to make the healthcare system better and more affordable for people. It also gives us a chance to deal with some of the inequities that have existed for a long time, as long as we have the staying power to do both. So I'll end with where I began with some notes of gratitude. I always say that the best antidote to stress is gratitude. So it's good to end there. We're going to be coexisting with this COVID virus for some time. We're going to be coexisting with some of the spotlights it's put on in disparities in care and the mental health and pieces that will come along with this. But that spotlight gives us an opportunity to address some things and get from that quiet to the peace. We are really grateful for the legislature and some of the tools you've helped us put in place, like, for example, supporting telemedicine and giving us the way to do that in a way that's important. We are not lost on the gravity of the financial pieces for healthcare. I will tell you that we budgeted, not-for-profit healthcare is a very thin margin. We budgeted for 1.5% margin this year. We will far, far south of that because of payment for COVID preparations and because of the decrease in scheduled procedures. So, and while we're grateful for state and federal funding, it will make up about maybe a quarter of our losses this year. So I'm not lost on the financial gravity and what it will mean for healthcare and how we'll have to come out of it. But I do think this gives us an opportunity like never before to come out of this stronger and better. It will take a lot of work. It will be bumpy getting there. But we will come out stronger for it, I think, as a community and as healthcare organizations. Lastly, and I think the greatest debt of gratitude that I have has to go to our employees. They have poured their hearts out to care for people under very difficult circumstances. They've raised their courage just remarkably to do so. They've innovated around things and about things, and they've given incredible care. When the community absolutely needed it most, from the frontline ICU worker to the highest person who supports telehealth efforts and way everything in between, there's not enough to be said by what they've given to this community and how they've served. So that's where I'll end my testimony. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. And we have a question from Mary Kunesh Padin. And after that question from Representative Kunesh Padin, we are going to go on to the next testifier to keep on schedule. Representative sure. Kunesh Padin.
Thank you very much. I think I raised my hand a little, maybe a little earlier than needed, because I get, my question is around addressing our communities of color and their heightened sensitivity to the COVID pandemic. And so you were talking about how you have built up stronger collaboration and partnerships across the medical profession. You talked about having deeper plans and making medicine and approaches to addressing this better and more affordable. But within our communities of color, can you give us some specifics or some examples of how that is being done, and hopefully the positive consequences of that really intentional approach to addressing those communities that maybe suffer more because of the lack of resources and finances and you know, just living closer together in this day and age?
Yeah,
Ms. Miller.
I think it's an incredibly important question, and I think now is the time that we really have an opportunity to address it. So we, as an organization, have been on this journey for quite a while, and we need to be on it for a lot deeper and for a lot longer. We located our headquarters in one of the most challenged areas of the Twin Cities. We support the global market and minority-owned businesses there that are really important to us. We set up, after the unrest, different testing sites and things like that for those who have been affected. We were the one sole pharmacy in the area of unrest. And we try to do all that we look at for in terms of looking at and measuring healthcare disparities and addressing them. And it's not deep enough, and it's still not enough. We had some testimony, I think, yesterday from the Somali community. And so we try to listen very hard. We've had, as many of you know, we've had a 10-year commitment to the Phillips Powderhorn neighborhood with something called the Backyard in partnership with the Cultural Wellness Center, and trying to work with our community and understanding them. And maybe I'll end with this. They taught us a very important lesson. We thought we'd come in as a healthcare and really, you know, tell the community what they needed to do to be healthier. And I got a lesson very early, and we did as an organization. No, the community can tell you what health looks like to them. It's not the absence of illness. It's having a roof. It's having a job. It's having safety. It's having security. It's having all of that. And our job as an organization is to try to support that. We need to do that in even deeper ways than we are today. We're doing a number of things that I don't have time to completely discuss, but the commitment there is there and will stay there, and that's a thread we will not lose as an organization.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, for your testimony. Next, we will go to Kevin Roshi. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is the president of Roshi Consulting. I think you need to be unmuted either by us or by you.
Sorry.
There you go.
Thank you for inviting me to talk with the committee. I appreciate the very wise remarks of Mr. Slavitt and Ms. Wheeler. What I wanted to do was just spend a couple of minutes talking about some things that I think are important to consider. It's been apparent to me since the beginning of the epidemic that it's an unusual epidemic in the sense that it's highly bifurcated by age, and it's very front-loaded. The most susceptible people have unfortunately become sick and in many cases died early on, and understanding that dynamic is certainly important for modeling and understanding the potential future course of it. The thing I've been most concerned about is the attempt to balance the responses to the epidemic with its actual nature, and to have people be cognizant of both the benefits and the harms of various measures taken to mitigate the spread of the virus. And in particular, as is unfortunately always the case, we have seen very extensive job loss to minority and low-income communities. Minority-owned businesses are particularly hard hit. The National Bureau of Economic Research has estimated that an astounding 41% of minority-owned businesses are likely to end up being permanently closed as a result of some of the actions that have been taken. I've also been concerned about the harms to health that result from some of the mitigation of spread arguments, and I think those harms need to be taken into account. Just in the past week, the director of the National Cancer Institute estimated that there would be as many as 60,000 excess deaths from breast and colon cancer alone. This is largely the result of people being frightened to seek health care, we see that as well. The Centers for Disease Control put out a study on vaccination rates. I know the Department of Health in the state has also expressed concerns about both vaccination rates and well child visit rates. If you go to the CDC website, they have very detailed information on excess deaths over what might be expected from various causes. And you will see there, and you can look specifically at Minnesota, that we are experiencing excess deaths from diseases like cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, and other causes. So I think it is important to be aware that it's not purely a matter of the economy versus what happens to people from coronavirus. It's a matter of the total impact of any public policy action on the population. As Andy mentioned, in Minnesota, we're very fortunate. The epidemic actually appears to be petering out here, both in frequency and certainly in severity. Our hospitalization rate is down, our rate of deaths is down. And as Andy also mentioned, people really don't know why. And it is a mystery that we are seeing these different patterns of spread around the country. Coronaviruses typically are highly seasonal. You see with the pre-existing strains a very strong drop-off in June, with a return typically in late October, November. Minnesota, maybe that's what's happening in Minnesota, but then you would wonder why it's not happening elsewhere. It does appear that even in the states where there is some resurgence, there is a lessening of severity of cases, even in those states. That, I think, is related to the notion I mentioned before that the virus tends to be able to infect and develop into a serious illness in the most susceptible people first, and the remaining population simply isn't likely to get as severe a disease. One thing I'd like to say about schools, I think a number of countries around the world have opened their schools. Most of them have done very extensive kind of literature reviews, contact tracing studies in the course of doing that or before doing that. Countries like Australia, the Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, and if you read those reviews and those studies, people clearly have concluded that not only is there low risk to children of developing the disease, certainly a serious illness, but that children generally are not transmitters of the disease. And the best evidence of that is always the contact tracing studies, and those detailed contact tracing studies, which have been done in a number of countries, generally find that children don't typically transmit to adults, but adults, especially in a household, do transmit to children occasionally. I think that's kind of my general comments. Happy to answer any questions people have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. A couple of quick questions. Number one, early on, we've seen that both in deaths and other metrics, that the Northeast was clearly different than the rest of the country. As statistical outliers of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, what factors would you say attribute to that? Why are they so much different than the other parts of the country?
Mr. Roshi.
I think one thing that took everybody by surprise was the fact that the virus clearly spread very widely before people were aware it was a serious illness. And that is partly due to China not giving people good and accurate information about what was going on. And I think it's also partly due to the fact that in many cases that spread was occurring among younger, healthier people who were traveling a lot. So New York and Boston, for example, both have an enormous amount of international travel, especially from Europe. And it appears that the virus came into those areas as much from or more from Europe than it did from China. And people have verified that by some of the genetic studies they can do about variations in the virus. I think in New York City in particular, a number of studies have identified that mass transit is a clear vector for transmission, and New York City has a lot of that. And it's the most densely populated city in the world. So I think that the Northeast, which is very densely populated and which probably had multiple sources of infection coming in before people realized it, just got hit with a wave that was well underway before they even realized it.
We have, yes, Representative Garofalo, did you have a short follow-up?
Yep, I just, thank you. My second question was, we've seen in states like Arizona and California, to differing degrees, they're seeing rising ICU levels going up, even though their states have very different responses. In Minnesota and Wisconsin, even though we have very different public policy responses, we're seeing relatively low ICU and death rates. Even though the public policy is very different in the states, we're seeing similar results. What would you attribute to them?
Mr. Roche.
I think actually at the end of the day, when you look at the statistics in most places, they'll end up relatively the same. They may end up a little worse in places that have very dense population because that does seem to facilitate spread. I think the jury's out on the extent to which any particular mitigation of spread tactic, whether it's closing schools, closing businesses, mask wearing, it's unclear the extent to which those have a significant effect on the course of an epidemic. The virus at this point, I think it's fair to say, is fairly present everywhere. Depending on the opportunities it has to infect people, I think will have something to do with the number of cases you see. I think when you properly adjust for factors like age and comorbidities and other things, the rates of hospitalization and deaths among different populations doesn't look significantly different. Sweden just published a very detailed set of demographics and other factors around their deaths and hospitalizations. And in all honesty, it looks astonishingly like Minnesota, right down to the percent of deaths in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, and the percents of deaths among people over the age of 75.
Thank you, Mr. Roche. Representative Kunesh Patin, we're going to go on to the next testifier. If we have time at the end, we can come back to additional questions for any of the testifiers. But to keep on schedule, we are going to move on to Dr. Sakina Nakhvi. And you can tell me if I'm pronouncing that anywhere close to correct, with Doctors for Health Equity. Welcome to the committee, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Majority Leader Winkler, Minority Leader Dowd, and honorable members of this important committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to participate in these proceedings. My name is Sakina Nakhvi, and I am a pulmonary and critical care physician who practices in the Twin Cities. I'm here today in my capacity as a board member of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, which is a Minnesota-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to educate healthcare professionals to work towards health equity. When I was invited to give my testimonial today, I had initially considered presenting data that the Minnesota Department of Health, the CDC, the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Tracker have made publicly available to us, but I reconsidered this in light of Mr. Slavitt's testimony, which was going to highlight much of the same. I was invited here to give my perspective as a healthcare provider on the front lines, and not as somebody who's directly involved in shaping health policy. I do hope that my testimony today will provide insight towards molding health policy that specifically addresses and attempts to lessen existing health disparities. Over the last 7 months, as we have watched COVID-19 ravage the globe, the realization of what we do not know continues to grow. Physicians are not often do not often find themselves in the position where they begin to question whether or not they know how to manage an illness, or if a consultant will be able to appropriately provide them with answers to the questions that they have. As somebody who provides direct patient care in both the inpatient and the outpatient settings, I have frequently been humbled by this emerging pathogen. Unlike other more familiar viral illnesses, which display a typical disease progression, SARS-CoV-2 seems to behave differently from one patient to the next. We routinely find ourselves at a loss because what should be true often isn't. And in areas hit hardest by the pandemic, providers have been placed in this uncomfortable position of having to pause and consider scarcity of resources. Ethics committees of all over the world have had to discuss whom to offer and from whom to withhold treatment. We're not soldiers. Contrary to the popular description of us in the press and the immense responsibility of triaging weighs even heavier in this current environment in which we are operating at a seemingly nonstop pace. Against this backdrop, many of us have wondered how it is that in the 21st century, in the most advanced country in the world, we are doing so poorly handling this pandemic. Why is it that the people most affected by COVID-19 are indigenous people, people of color, non-English speakers, and people who do not have access to health insurance? And why is it that we have not been able to make significant strides in doing better for our underserved communities with the seemingly limitless resources that we tout? As data continues to be disaggregated, we in healthcare have had reason to pause. Compared with whites, the rates of COVID-19 are higher in Black, Indigenous, and Latino communities, despite these racial groups being an overall minority in the state. Homelessness in these communities and cohorting at shelters and encampments like in the Powderhorn neighborhood has likely led to asymptomatic transmission and worsened rates of illnesses in these communities. There is this overarching mistrust of the medical community, which is perpetuated by systematic and systemic racism within our communities and our profession, frankly, and it has led to poor adherence to recommendations made by the medical community. Lack of access to telephones and internet has made it very challenging for our minority communities to access telemedicine, further deepening this divide and making it even more challenging to manage these issues at a community level. In the ICU, which is where I spend most of my time, it has been frightening to see this highly communicable disease run through households and take down families. I have taken care of many Somali, Hmong, and Latino patients and their family members. And to be sure, this is challenging at the best of times to have multiple members of the same family admitted to the hospital at the same time. But now, at the worst of times, when families are not allowed to be with their loved ones for concerns of them contracting the illness, and for concerns of shortage of personal protective equipment for healthcare providers. Family members of patients are able to view their loved ones over video conferencing and through interpreters, but without the touch and feel of their family members, struggle to often understand why we cannot do more to help their grandparent, their parent, their spouses, or their children. As a person of color and an immigrant myself, I have had patients ask me if we are giving up on their family members because they're not white, and it puts us in a very uncomfortable position. We have had multiple patient families send in food for the healthcare teams for weeks on end in the hope that this will parlay favor for their family members. And this is not okay. This is not where we should be as a people. We have to do better by our communities of color and our indigenous communities. I don't have a lot of answers for the questions surrounding how to best handle health inequities, but I can say with certainty that this disease is very real. And for a number of reasons, targeting those who are already disproportionately disadvantaged. If we are to take any lessons from the sobering second wave in Los Angeles, it is this: we need to be better stewards of science and of our society and the communities in which we live. In the words of Paul Wellstone, we all do better when we all do better. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. We did really want to have a practicing physician with us today to share, you know, what the experience is like in treating patients like this. And you spoke a little bit about the fact that this disease behaves differently from one patient to the next. I wonder if you could share an example of what you're seeing in different patient experiences with the disease.
Certainly. You know, I took care of a gentleman who presented to the emergency room probably about a month ago. He was put on mechanical ventilation pretty soon upon arrival to the ER. His oxygen saturations were in the 40s, and the normal oxygen saturations are, you know, 99 to 100. He was at work 3 days before presenting to the hospital. He had no blood pressure, and he was on multiple medications to help raise his blood pressure. They were able to get some imaging studies done on him and saw that he had a huge clot in the left side of his heart. And his initial COVID testing came back negative. And as we were stabilizing him in the ICU and, you know, placing various, you know, intravenous accesses, we noticed that he was bleeding out of every orifice. We had to stop the blood thinners that we were giving for the blood clot. The kidney physician said that the patient was too unstable to undergo dialysis. He was not making any urine, and his, you know, the acid level in his body was very high. And I must have spent about 8.5 hours in this one patient's room. And, you know, later that night, I, you know, through the supervisor at the hospital, I said, we have to let the family come in and say their goodbyes to him because he's not going to make it through the night. We had a couple of family members come in, and then we withdrew care on him by removing the ventilation, mechanical ventilation, and withdrawing all the drugs we were giving to support him. And I rotated off the service, and I came back 3 days later, and the patient was walking around and talking, making urine, and tested positive for COVID 3 days later. I don't think any of us has been stumped by a disease in this fashion, where what we know to be true in, you know, in you or me in non-COVID related stuff is completely untrue. I don't find myself to be an expert at guiding people in end of life cares anymore. You know, I just spent a weekend in the ICU where I had 18 patients who were 35 days plus on a ventilator. This is unheard of. This is not what we do in an ICU. You know, by day 18, 19, 20, we tell families we need to stop. And we are just, we're stumped because this has never been seen before. And so, you know, from one patient to the next, what would be true for a non-COVID patient is not true in a COVID patient, you know. And from one room to the next in a COVID ICU, what's happening to one patient is not happening to the next patient if we were to draw conclusions from, you know, patients that we're seeing. And it just puts us in a very uncomfortable position. And you sort of add to that, you know, this fatigue that we experience emotionally and physically. You know, I think across the country, and I guess I can speak for the Twin Cities, I have plenty of friends who are ICU doctors. We are in the ICU 21, 22 days every 4 weeks. I mean, we are emotionally at a breaking point, and we cannot have families come in. We are told not to touch patients as much as we can. This is not how we are used to dispensing medicine. We're used to holding people's hands. We're used to helping people die in a dignified way. And when we withdraw care on patients in the ICU, families aren't around, and the healthcare providers, the doctors, the nurses, the respiratory therapists are all in the patient's room so that the patient doesn't die alone. And it's very emotionally taxing for us. And, you know, it's scary because we're not really sure what the end is. And if there's a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, LA is a very sobering story for us where, you know, we've done everything right. And it just seems like whatever sacrifice we're making, are they just all going to be awash if we need to reopen, which thank God I'm not in a position that I have to make any decisions like that. It's very hard. People are dying of hunger on the one hand, but they are very really dying of COVID on the other hand.
Thank you. Do any other members have any questions for Dr. Nakvi? Thank you so much for your testimony. We really appreciate your time today and the work that you're doing. Our next testifier is Jennifer D. Cabellis. I hope I'm saying that right, the CEO for Hennepin Healthcare Systems. So thank you for joining us today.
You are. Thank you, Speaker Hortman, members of the committee. As mentioned, I'm Jennifer DeCabellis. I'm the CEO for Hennepin Healthcare System, and I'm grateful to be able to join you today. Hennepin Healthcare, as many of you know, is a system of care that includes Hennepin County Medical Center, HCMC, a nationally recognized level one trauma center, but it also includes an expansive specialty and primary care clinic system located across Hennepin County. But this health system truly serves all of Minnesota and oftentimes beyond because of some of our expertise. I often refer to Hennepin Healthcare as a trifecta for healthcare. Not only are we a nationally recognized teaching hospital, we have excellence in our services as a second arm, but we also have research and ensuring that we remain on the cutting edge for healthcare innovation for the people that we serve. If you package that trifecta with the mission for serving all Minnesotans, regardless of their race, their income, you'll see that we are a true safety net for health investment in our community and here to serve Minnesota. We're known for excellence in a lot of areas. Some of that is for trauma, it is for burn, it is for TBI, traumatic brain injury, addiction, mental health. We've got a strong home health and hospice arm. And in particular, right now, we've leaned heavily on our expertise in infectious disease. The list goes on, but we are a critical resource to Minnesotans. And with almost half of our population qualified for Medicaid in healthcare, we are a critical safety net provider, truly here for Minnesota. As I mentioned, 60% of our over half of our patient population is Medicaid qualified, but of that, 60% of our patient population is non-white, and 20% prefer a language other than English. You've heard from several presenters already today the criticality of what we're seeing in response to COVID-19 and the disproportionate impact for people of color, and we certainly are seeing that in Hennepin County. Many of the people we serve are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19 and to what we're seeing in our community due to chronic health issues, due to food insecurity, transportation barriers. 1 in 5 of the people we serve are experiencing some housing instability. So we are a real critical bridge between a true health system, but also those human service supports that provide not only life-sustaining supports and health and wellness for individuals, but an ability to truly thrive in our community. We have 7,000 employees who proudly provide care for patients from all over Minnesota. And the summer is not just about COVID-19. As one of the largest Trauma One hospitals, we are seeing increased patients from around the state who need intensive care due to other reasons. So keeping that balance of keeping ICU capacity to respond to COVID-19 when we're seeing such an influx in the metro area in particular, but also keeping that capacity for trauma has been critical so that we can respond to accidents or drowning or burn injuries. And more than ever, I think as you see in the evening news, when an incident happens in Minnesota, more often than not, those individuals are brought in to Hennepin Healthcare as the responding agency. And hopefully today you'll hear us highlight that when Minnesota needs us, we've been there. And that has never been more true than in the response to the current pandemic. Similar to what other healthcare systems and Penny Wheeler testified here today, we are also at the forefront of the COVID-19 pandemic. As I mentioned, we have been a state resource, and I'm going to highlight a couple of ways that we've been a state resource and then particularly talk about some of the disparities we're seeing and how we're working to respond to make sure that all Minnesotans are getting the health care that they need. A couple of ways that we've responded to the pandemic is early on in the pandemic, we loaned one of our key leaders, our director of emergency preparedness for HCMC and one of our emergency physicians, Dr. John Hick, to MDH, who has been instrumental in leading efforts to coordinate the statewide response. There was a need, we answered it and partnered with the state. When the state also put a call out for needing testing, Hennepin Healthcare System raised our hand and responded. In partnership with MDH, we brought up new testing equipment and capacity. We have done over 30,000 tests. We have 24-hour turnaround for that testing capacity. And in partnership with our local public health departments, we not only created viral walk-in clinics in rapid succession, but we also realized early on that the disproportionate impact to the communities we serve was critical, and not everybody could come to us. So we created mobile community testing, where our community paramedics from EMS and our community clinicians from our home health partnered together to deploy out and respond to vulnerable populations who were less likely to be able to access those testing services and come in. And that was everything from congregate care settings to homeless shelters, to other group homes for individuals with disabilities. And more recently, we had a call from the Somali community to figure out how we could do some extensive mobile testing there as well, and we were able to deploy. There is a ton of work to be done, but hopefully what you'll hear is, as Penny mentioned earlier, as health systems, we have rallied alongside the state to make sure we respond and that we are leveraging our internal expertise to be there for our community at this time. At Hennepin Healthcare, we've seen some of the highest number of patients for COVID-19 at our facility. We have gone into surge capacity here, and we've partnered with our other health systems, which, as Penny mentioned, has been just incredible response. When we've had to divert to other healthcare systems, there's been an incredible partnership across Minnesota to make sure that residents are taken care of. And how do we help each other at those critical times so that, again, we could stay open for some of the trauma demands? End to end, our system is working to keep our residents healthy and to make sure we are responding to the pandemic. I want to talk a little bit quickly about some of the disproportionate disparities that we're seeing. So all of this that I've mentioned has been an effort to combat COVID-19 pandemic that's hitting us as a community right now. But the health disparities have been impacting us for decades. And my hope is that this is a call to action to Minnesota. As you know, Minnesota is often at the top of most health indicators. We are known as a state that leads in healthcare. As soon as you sort that by race, we are in the bottom of the nation. We are competing for the bottom 4, 5, 6 slots. And COVID-19 has taught us more than ever that we are only healthy in Minnesota when everybody in Minnesota is healthy. So I can't emphasize enough how critical that is at this time. We have seen community testing and social services being able to change the line, but we also have huge opportunities. So a quick, and I'll submit these numbers, but a quick couple of numbers to share with you. As I mentioned, we've done testing and we've processed over 30,000 tests in our lab since March for COVID-19. Of those, 4,300 have returned positive results. And of those 4,300 results, over half of those positives are in non-English speaking patients. 42% of them come from the Latinx community, of which 28% represent our hospitalizations. Highly overrepresentative. 32% of those positives are Black or African born, and they are 38% of our hospitalizations. Native Americans make up 15% of our hospitalizations. So hopefully you hear, as one of the largest facilities seeing COVID-19 patients, the disproportionality of who we're seeing need that ICU and acute care capacity has been eye-opening. 13% of those positive cases have been homeless in the past or are currently homeless. Within the last month, we did a quick survey of people that were COVID positive, patients and those at high risk for becoming positive. We had about 400 respondents to that. And I wanna just highlight a couple of those outcomes. 60% of our Latinx respondents and 42% of Black respondents reported food insecurity. 23% of Native American and 17% of Black respondents reported housing instability. And when asked about the fear or inability to pay rent or a mortgage, these numbers more than doubled. That tells us what's to come. So not only are we just getting past that first wave of the pandemic, but we have a lot of people living on the edge, worried about employment, worried about housing, and we don't have systems that are working well together in order to stand up those services and supports. I'm gonna highlight real quickly a couple of things we're doing to address those disparities, but there's more work to be done. A couple of things are 75% of our remdesivir recipients at HCMC have been Black or Latinx. This medication has been proven to be life-saving. We have ECMO within our walls and have expanded our capacity. We were recently approved as a platinum level ECMO site. That ECMO is critical in some of the life-saving efforts that we have across Minnesota. And for the population we serve, it's been critical in turning around. We're standing up community capacity, as I mentioned, but we're not just doing the testing capacity in the community. We're providing hand sanitizer and masks for people who otherwise don't always have access to what some of us take for granted every single day. We're also putting out culturally specific communications and video messaging about COVID, talking about prevention, treatment, testing, and more through videos that are coming from our very own doctors who represent the communities most affected and are coming out in multiple languages. These videos have focused on critical misinformation, sharing prevention information, and dealing with sensitive cultural issues to make sure that we bring these numbers down. We're sending home masks, not just for people coming into our facilities, but for family members, in order to, again, make sure that when we talk about everybody social isolating and staying home with masks, that's a privilege. And a lot of the folks we serve and see don't have the means to do that. We're also connecting patients with food insecurity to open arms for medically tailored meals, so they're able to stay home and stay safe and not go hungry. In addition, we developed an emergency food delivery model. We found people who tested positive could be stranded at home without food if they're listening to our orders to shelter in place. And in order to keep them from going out and exposing others, we have a model set up to deliver groceries. The largest group we aim to serve are COVID positive, half of those whom are Spanish speakers. We have a lot more work to do. Certainly the impact around the hospital systems has been huge. As a safety net hospital, we're losing $20 to $30 million a month. We don't have those kind of margins to sustain ourselves, but we also know the services we provide are so critical to Minnesotans. We took on impacts from civil unrest. So we lost two of our pharmacies and our East Lake Clinic was completely destroyed. We have made a commitment to the community to stay in that community, to continue to be a service provider there. We know the criticality of the services and our commitment to the community has never been stronger. But we also have a commitment to transform healthcare so no one is left behind, because we know that overall, better outcomes for all means lower costs for all. And there's ways that the state can help. So I have three quick state recommendations that I think will help us going forward. The first is, how do we focus healthcare from these deep end services and really move to prevention and early intervention. We know everyone must do their own part by, as Andy mentioned, staying home, staying masks, doing restrictions, but not everybody has that luxury. So standing up social service supports with healthcare that allow those where social distancing is a privilege and they can't do that, the means to keep themselves safe could not be more critical. Second is to keep the flexibilities in the system short term. We have, what excites me about what we've been through is we have gotten back to practicing medicine versus chasing rules and regulations. And I'm hoping that as a state, we don't go backwards. The telehealth waivers have been instrumental. I have seen stories about 70-year-olds who are safely isolating at home, but because of that isolation are struggling with addiction. And that telemedicine and that capability to keep them connected to care providers has been the game changer between that and relapse. I've seen young moms struggling at home with multiple children and avoiding a two-month-old wellness check. Telemedicine is allowing us to do that. So I can't emphasize enough that some of the barriers at the very population we serve around transportation, around childcare, instead of paying for those really expensive services in isolation and still having a high no-show rate, the ability to make access to healthcare prevention and early intervention easier for people is instrumental. Keeping people on Medicaid is another one I would emphasize. We see a 15% churn on and off of Medicaid just for paperwork. That is an administrative expensive system because there's a lot of work that those social services folks have to put in to get somebody requalified. In the meantime, they disconnect from care and the very prevention and early intervention that we as a community need. So keeping that in place has been instrumental as well. And then I sit on the Blue Ribbon Commission for the state, and I can't emphasize enough that we have as a state built programs, not responses. And the pandemic has taught us that we truly have an opportunity right now to transform how we do healthcare and stop administering programs, but truly provide care that works for people and get some of the rules and regulations out of our way. And a final point I would make is those longer term investments. So not just the short term regulatory relief, but the long term investments in truly standing up a system in Minnesota that works for everybody, that moves that funding upstream and gets us to investing in our most vulnerable populations early on. As was mentioned by an earlier presenter, we all do better when we all do better. And I think this moment has really highlighted the need for us to do that. So I can't emphasize enough that this is a marathon. It's not a sprint, and the effects of COVID-19 will be with us, but it's also an opportunity to do better in Minnesota, and we stand ready to continue to partner in that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see anybody's hands up, which is kind of good because it's 11:28 and we're done at 11:30. But one thing I did just want to mention and ask you a little bit about in the couple minutes we have left is I know that Hennepin County has made a declaration that racism is a public health crisis. And I imagine that there's no way for you to answer this question in a minute or 30. But has Hennepin Healthcare figured out how to take that declaration and start to develop an action plan around it? Much of what you testified to was that COVID-19 has really shown the spotlight on these racial inequities in healthcare to begin with, and others have spoken about it today. But I just wondered, in particular, is the county going to be dedicating resources or what are your preliminary thoughts on racism as a public health crisis?
Absolutely, and thank you for that question. So we are working on what, how do we co-design? I think that would be the key. So you heard me talking about transforming healthcare. How do we truly co-design what works for communities with communities? So an example of that is as we stand up our East Lake Clinic, we're not just rebuilding a traditional clinic. We're looking at what does the community need? Let's build that bridge with social services. Let's build that bridge with the community, and let's co-design healthcare together and try to keep those rules and regulations and the payment sources from driving healthcare and truly use the base of those needs. So we're doing that end-to-end with lots of community input, and that work will take us years. But it will take partnership with the state, because a lot of what drives us is the program approach. As we've built programs over time at the state level, they have different rules and regulations and hoops you jump through, and we have gotten to a system that follows that funding and that regulatory arm versus truly practicing medicine in partnership with what community needs.
Well, thank you very much for your time here today and your testimony. Thank you for all of the testifiers, and to the members for making time. I'm sure we all have a lot more conversation to have about COVID-19 and the correct approaches for Minnesota to take from a policy standpoint, but the information that the experts have shared with us today, I'm certain will inform our debate beginning as early as Monday, July 13th, in a likely special session. So thank you very much. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.